that sneeze.
Good evening. This is Teresa Dietze and David Franco, or David Franco and Teresa Dietze, with Practical Work on Self. Tonight we discuss Chapter 20, Centrum of Cosmos, and then go on to move into New Day Every Day.
Okay.
Where would you like to start tonight, David?
I suggest that we start at the beginning and move our way through until we hit the end, and then we stop at that point.
Kind of like a worm moving through an apple.
A what?
Kind of like a worm moving through an apple.
Oh, apple. I thought it was a different word that you had said relating to the human anatomy, but...
Well, there's no accounting for some people's minds. Now, that's
yeah.
Not the centrum of cosmos. Let's jump into the real centrum of cosmos.
Oh. Okay. Leap away, miss.
So, first of all, does anybody have any questions from over the last week or any experiences that they would like to share about the chapter Centrum of Cosmos? It's a difficult chapter with a lot of language in there, and so, of course, as always, we welcome questions.
And just to orient ourselves once again, we're working with Practical Work on Self by E.J. Gold, and we've been working on it for a number of weeks, and as we were heading toward the last portion of the book, we're now on Chapter 20, as Teresa said, Centrum of Cosmos.
I choose an object. I mean, it is a tough exercise, I agree with you, Teresa. I choose a butterfly that is hanging in my living room. I have a butterfly hanging there. But in any case, it could have been anything. It could have been the forgotten bottle of beer from a week ago, right beside the thing, I guess, isn't it?
Yes.
But man, that would have been really tough to see that bottle of beer at the center of the solar centrum. But, so I see the object. The object was there, and I can just arrange everything around as if I were an aesthetician or an architect to see where you put the table. So I somehow start arranging the whole reality around my butterfly right there.
Yeah.
Yeah. At the moment, you look at it and you say, yeah, I see it. You know, you see some sacredness in an object, but it goes away. You know, it's too big the reality to relate it only to that object. And mostly, if it is an object that it really doesn't say anything, like it could be stone on the floor, a bottle of forgotten beer, the doorknob. So how would you fix that? The whole universe around that object.
Okay, so in case anyone's just coming in tonight, what Guillermo is talking about here is the exercise in Centrum of Cosmos, which is to pick an object, any object, and to consider that one object as if it's the solar absolute or the centrum of the cosmos, and to experience what we might experience if we were confronted with the center of the universe. So Guillermo's saying that he picked a butterfly in his living room for this purpose, and it really didn't matter what he picked, whether it was a bottle of beer or a butterfly, the exercise would remain the same. So what you're saying, Guillermo, is that some of the time you were able to bring that feeling forth in imagining it to be so, and at other times it was difficult to remember the practice? Is that what
you're saying? No, it wasn't a matter of remembering. I mean, that's a different issue. That remembering belongs to a different file. But it's holding that object, whatever that is. I mean, some object may be easier to say, hey, the Statue of the Liberty, you know, it's a lot of presence there. I mean, you can fantasize and try to, it will help you in the exercise. But
okay.
If you just pick any object like that, it's very hard to even visualize that the rest of the universe is surrounding the existence of that little object. It's tough to visualize that.
Yes, it is.
Nevertheless, it gives you, there is a feeling here, though, that yes, there is a feeling, and I have experienced that, the feeling of how everything is that is existing is a sacred thing, is sacred somehow.
So, in this case, so then you pressed against the exercise, it was very difficult, and yet, something came to you, right?
Yes.
Yeah. A certain essential feeling hits you as you were trying to do the exercise and, in fact, doing the exercise.
Yes, sir.
Let's take a quick tour to the chapter. And if Teresa and Silverdale can help out a bit, because I'm going to, for myself, I'm going to stumble a bit as I get through some of the terminology here. But as we do so, it does actually present us with a bit of a path. And it's a path that we can take, can do something. How does that sound? Or does somebody else want to jump in?
Any questions from the people who've just recently joined us?
Hi, everybody. It's Diana. Sorry I was a little late on the call. I just wanted to say, Guillermo, I loved the explanation that you offered last week because I have really found this to be difficult. So, yeah, I would appreciate some first-hand examples on how to do this because I did not do it.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm glad, Diana.
Yeah, that was really good last week, Guillermo. Thanks.
Very welcome.
So, and once again, we're reminded that we are working in group here, and so we get to share from each other's experience rather than working independently, which is much more difficult. So, now I find the first two paragraphs, actually, of the chapter very interesting. That's on page 153. Alone we can easily visualize the human biological machine as the solar absolute, the crown of creation, or as the moon, a new formation at the tail end of the scale of creation. But with others, we can never see the machine as the solar absolute because of the tensions, emanations, and radiations of others. And at the same time, the machine's automatic tensions in relation to the machines of others. What is E.J. Gold saying to us in those first two paragraphs then? Just whatever comes to mind.
I don't know what E.J. is necessarily saying there. I have some ideas, but for me, one thing this several paragraphs evoke is the difference between the I-you relationship or I-it relationship and the I-thou relationship, which is so difficult for many of us to achieve. We have a tendency to see self as subject and other as object.
Okay.
I have another angle on that. That is pretty much somehow what you say, Teresa. But I say, in few words, what AJ for me is telling that it's easier for you to see yourself as the center of the universe than to see the other one. The other one is just another one. But because I am the perceptor, I am the center here. So So it's all centered in yourself.
Right,
but
we're looking
you don't see
out.
That you don't see that in the you don't see that in the other person.
Right.
We look out at everybody, and when we look out at people, and
right.
then there's the tensions and the judgments that are there. I'm getting some feedback. Somebody might need to mute their line.
Is
my own voice coming back?
Turn their computer volume down too.
Right.
They're on the phone.
Yeah, that
was oh, that's better. Pardon me?
Hey,
it was me. I'm
not here. Oh, yes. Thank you, Mike. Diana?
You were starting to talk about something last week about the different energy, when energy is more dense versus when it's more expansive. I was trying to understand what you were saying as we move through these various levels. Can you help me understand how I should be focusing on one object and magnifying that, and how that ties into what you were talking about? Like there's more energy, or there's you know different images as you move through various levels. Am I saying this properly?
I'm not sure what you're referring to yet. Without a context, somebody
you're
else.
You're saying it properly for yourself, Diana.
What's that?
You're saying it properly for yourself.
That's right, but I'm trying to tie together two. I just finished listening to the tape from last class, and that's why I'm
okay.
struggling to understand. It seems that this is where I have a gap right now, and I need help. It seems like what we were talking about was one was taking an object and magnifying it and making it very of utmost importance. But then when we were talking about the octaves last week, how if I understood you, Chi, and I may not have, you were saying something about as you move in these various phases of enlightenment, energy is more expansive and available to us. Does that sound familiar?
No. Today is a new day, every day. Memory.
She was channeling.
Pardon?
She was channeling. She can't remember what she channeled.
No, and I didn't. And I was hurried. Normally, I listen to the tape and I'll write comments down verbatim, but I just didn't have enough time tonight. All right, I'm just going to stand down and know that I'm just confused in this chapter.
Well, yeah. You'll have an opportunity because, for one thing, we some of these short chapters. I know you tend to listen to them twice, and if you want to bring that context back up in another class, then we can certainly address it. And also, when this course is finished, after chapter 24, we will have, probably several weeks apart, several question and answer sessions where people can bring experiences and questions from the book so that we can follow through instead of leaving you high and dry. And while we're on topic with that, we will possibly follow through by working with the human biological machine. We still need to make a final decision about that.
Okay.
Other questions or comments on Centrum of Cosmos? And then David, maybe. Oh, it looks like there's something online here. Townsy Girl, I thought the point was to kind of choose something kind of trivial to focus and change our perspective.
Not really. I mean, that's good too, but that's not this particular, exercise. This particular exercise is reintroducing us to a topic that we've kind of danced with a little bit over the last several weeks, several months actually now, and that's the idea that the the emanation, in a sense, from the uncreated, something happened, and it emanated, and it came into creation. And that is called the crown of creation. It's the, prior to that, it's the Ein Sof. It's the Brahma waiting to activate and pour forth and become the world. And that emanation comes from, in a sense, the unmanifested. It's the beyond our understanding. And suddenly it starts to become and manifest as creation. When we walk around in creation, what would it be like? What would it be like if we could stand in the position and see that moment of creation, that exhibit of manifestation? And the exercise is to find any object, and suddenly start watching it in that manner, that everything around us is a manifestation from that source. What would it be like? What does it feel like that that's the case? And sometimes as we go through, we can see that we can get a whiff of that. And it's part of some of these exercises, it's to be able to stand in that particular mood of unknowing, in that particular unknowing that comes about from doing that particular kind of exercise. It's a form of invocation that we can do on our own. Sometimes if we're in a more experienced group, that kind of invocation can come about, that the entire group, in a sense, gets to see, and you're left with it. It leaves a bit of a mark. And it's, that mark becomes a orientation point. And if you can pay attention to that mood, and that mood can be a manner of navigation, in a sense, to get back to that same point.
Can you tell us what an invocation is?
Well, if you do this exercise and you knock your head against it, so that your head can't function anymore. The comfortable, associative, literal, and linear thinking that we're so used to just can't get this idea. And if you've gotten this idea in that manner, you didn't get it. So once you're in that in-between space, will you, A, you don't give up, and yet at the same time, that voyager, who is you at that moment, has no place to rest their head. Something can come through at that time, and it is a form of knowledge, but it's a different type of knowledge.
So by invocation, you're talking about bringing something through oneself and into oneself. How is an invocation different from what's known as channeling?
Well, I'm not that familiar with channeling. I mean, I've read stuff about people who channel. I've talked to people who are presumably channels. And in that case, they, in a sense, get out of the way for that entity to come through, whatever the nature of that particular entity is. They aren't participants in this. We're talking about intentionality and the exercise of will. We want to work with exercising our will. If you are exercising the will of attention and you awaken the machine from time to time, the being has a chance that there's something that can start to occur there. So invocation, you are an active participant. It is active, difficult, and important work. You're part of it.
So you're talking about co-creation with a specific type of energy that's possible by focusing the attention and being receptive.
That sounds close. It's the effort, the organ of intentionality, of working your attention, intention and your attention. And it's in that workforce that something is possible. This is not a passive thing that occurs and suddenly it's there. In fact, if you are in passivity and a group invocation is going on, you just won't be there. In some one way or another, you, that passive individual, will be eliminated. You'll eliminate yourself.
Or potentially make it impossible for the group to access that state together.
If the space is important, you will be eliminated. You won't be there. You'll fall asleep. You'll have to walk out of the room for some reason. In tragic spaces, you'll be asked to leave.
Sounds like the Borg. You will be assimilated, but that's when it works.
Yeah.
Hi there. This is Jenny. I was wondering if either of you or anyone listening has had that experience.
Absolutely.
I have.
What's it like?
What is what like, Jenny?
When you have focused on an object so much that it that you have this transformation where you're not thinking about it in the normal brain set. So how
you
I don't know how to ask it.
Jenny,
okay.
You probably had that with your plant.
Hang on a second, please.
Okay.
Jenny, do you mind if we run a little process right now?
Please do.
Okay. So can you ask the question again?
Okay. Here's the question. What does it feel like to change this way of feeling or thinking about an object so that you're not thinking of it in the normal way that it's that you or it goes through this transformation?
When you say, what does it feel like, what do you mean by that?
Well, like, what I used as part of my exercise this week was, as I was hiking, to try to use my poles as the focus of my attention. And so I tried to think of them as the divine, but I never got past the place where it was simply all of my thinking was just in my head.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering how, if I were using the poles as an example of trying to turn my hiking poles into a divine substance, how does that transformation take place? But can you understand my question?
Oh, I understand it. What transformation are you talking about again?
The transformation that happens within me, if I'm understanding the exercise correctly, that if I put all of my my intention and my attention,
yes,
on this object, that I feel that it is the soul or absolute, that somehow the way that I feel about this object, at least, is going to change.
Yeah, If you had that experience, what would it feel like?
And that's what I'm trying to ask you. I thought that that's sort of what you were describing as a group, that's what can happen.
I'll tell you why I'm asking it in the way I am. Obviously, I understand your question. It's
okay.
Because when I heard you speak, I caught a whiff of the fact that I think you have experienced this. I got a whiff of the feeling that you have just a little touch of it that you've picked up as you were doing that exercise. And rather than attempt to explain it to you, which is me, is to see if we couldn't bring it forth in you. Because it's in you. It is in you. We're the same person.
Upasni Maharaj, perfect master in India, used to say that if you worshipped a stone with full sincerity, you could become God-realized or enlightened, because you would have to bring forward the qualities of God in yourself in order to project them onto that stone.
Oh, wow. So part of that exercise, which is part of what's discussed in the chapter, is to suspend your... when you look at those two things that were in your hands, can you suspend the tactile, visual, mental belief that those were hiking poles?
Well, there was a little time when I felt more that it was an extension of myself, or that my aura was bigger, and that it was more an extension of my power and stuff like that. But see, I wasn't ever sure that was really a sensation, or if it was just a cool sounding idea that came from my head, and I went, "Oh yeah, that sounds good," you know, that kind of thing.
Well, that's not bad. As long as you continue to struggle with it, and God forbid that you don't suddenly think, yeah, I know exactly what they mean now. That's much better, and it's much more organic and alive to be in that moment of unknowing. And that I call a sacred moment.
Okay, well, I hope it gets a little better than that.
Okay.
So before you move on, Silverdale had made some comments online, and I wanted to read them.
All right.
So before Tanti Girl asked, what is the definition of cosmology? And Silverdale had said, to escape personal death, the absolute created reciprocal feeding and maintenance, the food chain, the absolute retains one-third of prime being for himself as the source of new arisings. One third of himself is now existing creation flowing back into the prime source. One third is the force of reconciliation, neutralizing, harmonizing, and spiritualizing of the absolute and his creation. The creation from the prime source of all the new arisings to the moon, which is the extent to which the absolute extends, is the absolute manifested materially. Okay, well, you can explain that to me, because I'm lost on that one, because I don't know what the moon means in this, in the way this is formulated. And then he said, man's evolutionary and transformational possibility arise from his ability to mimic the absolute within the laws of creation, which is what we're talking about to some extent. When we are alone, it's easy to imagine ourselves as the absolute. With others, we're overwhelmed by the creation and become a part of it ourselves. Yes, nice. And Townsy Grohl, I get that is sleeping, to, that it's sleeping to assume we are the center, yes?
And he said, we are asleep when our non-phenomenal self is not functioning. When our non-phenomenal self is active, then we're considered to be awake. Either the non-phenomenal self or the historical personality may be active. One hand washes the other.
When we go out into society and suddenly we're confronted with the impact, the tidal wave of impressions and emotions,
yes,
all that of everybody around us, we're blown out of the ability to see things from a different perspective. The analogy that Silverdale gave is summed up, at least for on the Christian side of things, as the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. One phrase.
So what is this moon business, and why is it that the absolute extends only to the moon? That doesn't make sense to me, because the moon, you know, it's just not all that far out there in space.
But on page 154, on the second to the last full paragraph, but for moons, comma, new beings formed of negative energy. So what could that mean? For moons, new beings formed of negative energy. And then the last paragraph, what do you think it might mean to feed the moon in oneself? Without this internal moon, the machine cannot attain imbalance and disharmony necessary to function as a transformational apparatus.
Stumped.
Well, look, it's as simple as this. At the moment of your conception, at the moment of the conception of any one of us, we are comprised of three co-equal forces, an active force, a passive force, and a reconciling force. That is a sperm, an ovum, and the blending of those two together. And in that moment of our personal conception, even if we've forgotten it, we are the absolute. For us, everything... there is complete unity in everything, and because we have no time measurements, it seems to last eternally, and that becomes the first impression against which everything else in our lives is subsequently measured. In exactly the same moment of our conception, when we are experiencing ourselves as the absolute, the moment that the division, the multiplication, and the diversification of that new individual begins, that is our personal moon. That is, our moon is at the other end of the spectrum of creation, where
from the absolute within us also.
Right. So, and all of our lives, what we're attempting to do, this is in accordance with Gurdjieff's theories, we're trying to grow our moon to become a planet. So, for example, Gurdjieff would say that the moon that's circling our planet is in the process of growing up to become a planet of its own, and it's getting its energy from all of the decomposition on the planet Earth, including our personal death. Now, I'm not going to argue whether that's literal or figurative, but in any event, this is the general idea. And our Earth is presently in the process of growing and will one day become a sun, like our solar sun, and in a similar type of way. Now, this, of course, completely contrary to modern astronomy, but that's not the point. So anyway, when it talks about in order for our moon to grow, that is, in order for our personality to grow back or to return to the absolute, we have to go through a series of growth processes, and we do that through experiencing life. That's the negative energy that gives to us the food that allows us to grow, in the same way that an infant child at the end of gestation, its birth, subsequently feeds on mother's milk, is weaned from that, begins to eat more substantial food, and even still continues to grow and passes through a stage puberty and so on, right on up to the day of retirement and subsequent passing.
So when it says here, without this internal moon, the machine cannot attain the balance and disharmony necessary to function as a transformational apparatus, I can understand that because we've been talking about that all along, using
yep.
our disharmony and our imbalance to wake ourselves up.
Right.
But that when you're talking about feeding the moon, is that feeding the moon in order to... feeding the moon could be a useful thing to the work, or it could be sort of the opposite of working, depending on how that term is being used. What does Gurdjieff mean, or EJ mean, by feeding the moon in this context?
Right, what he means is this, and again, this comes straight out of Gurdjieff. The general idea is that when people die on the planet Earth, in the moment of their passing, they release a little bit of heat or a little bit of energy in the form of vibrations. And those are magnetized to the moon and become part of the moon's nourishment. It's like a mother feeding a child. So the whole purpose of our... We have no purpose for being alive. There's no meaning to us being alive other than the fact that we're a herd of cattle intended for slaughter, so that in our personal death, some portion of energy is released from us and is magnetized to the moon. Of course, this is on a great cosmic scale, right? So, as Gurdjieff goes on to say, there are two ways that the death of a human being can release energy. Release energy to feed the moon. If it's a highly developed individual, and now I just have to kind of make up some relative numbers, if it's a highly developed evolutionary individual, when he dies, he might give off 100 something or others that go to feed the moon. But for most of us, being just ordinary people, when we die, we give off one. So you can see you'd need 100 deaths of ordinary people to equal one death of somebody who was highly developed that is releasing that energy. And so the whole reason that we have wars on this planet, according to Gurdjieff, is so that nature can slaughter a lot of us all at once to produce a certain amount of energy, which really serves only as mother's milk for the moon. So, and that's why at the beginning of this chapter it says, in the great cosmic scheme of things, we have no place at all because we're just involuntary slaves. We are sheep intended for slaughter only. That's the only interest great nature has in any one of us, that we're going to eventually die and release some energy.
Okay. So what I'd asked was, what do you think it might mean to feed the moon in oneself?
Oh.
Which is, I think, that's more directly symbolic. We can't really, I don't think we can effectively in this context discuss the esoteric chunk of interest that you just shared with us. But we can discuss what it means to feed the moon in oneself. Are we going to... sacrificing something then?
No, Teresa, thank you very much for narrowing down my explanation. It's as simple as this. Rather than express outwardly negative emotion, which builds up in us as a result of the stress that we are experiencing from the outside world, we hold that stress within ourselves and manage it. And in this way, we are creating the energy necessary to allow our moon to grow.
Well, in a sense, I would think that was similar to work wish,
right,
where you could sacrifice your reaction
right.
on the outside in order to contain your energy for the work. And
right.
by making that sacrifice, you could feed the moon. But I just didn't know if feeding the moon was a good thing or a bad thing, if the moon was... all made out of negative emotions, but then if we need the moon for in order to form a counter force for our will to awaken, and in order to reflect to ourselves, like the moon reflects the sun, then our negativity and our imbalance and disharmony can be used to help us awaken. And feeding that would, I believe, partially be becoming aware of it and
right.
awake to it, so that we can use it to wake up rather than running it unconsciously with the machine.
Right, and the mantra that Gurdjieff, or the two things that Gurdjieff has said in that regard: conscious labor, intentional suffering. So we're consciously laboring to understand these dynamics, and we're intentionally suffering in the sense that we don't throw up on the people around us. We try to manage it within ourselves.
Intentional suffering is more than that. I just want to make a distinction because of some of the people on the call. Intentionally suffering is not self-punishment.
That's right, correct.
That's correct.
It's awareness, awareness of suffering.
Suffering is using your suffering to awaken yourself and bringing your intention, your work intention, to your suffering so that your suffering can serve your transformation.
You're absolutely right, Teresa.
Nicely said. Nicely said, Teresa.
Thanks, Jane.
You're welcome. That was for you, partly.
Good. It was clear, Silver Day. That was good move.
Oh,
pardon me, I didn't hear you, Guillermo. Please repeat.
No. Good setup. Good setup, Silver Day, too. The feeding of the moon.
Yeah, well, thanks, Overdale. Thank you, Val. That was good dialogue.
That was a nice dialogue. We all kind of got going there and took something that was obscure and began to bring it into our work in a way that we can understand and orient from the previous chapters, which is that's great. So, David, anything?
Well, I like that explanation. It was very good. Particularly, I want to point out the idea of the not expressing the negative emotions, because this is something that happens constantly throughout the day. It happens all the time that we experience negative emotions. As we begin to get an overlay of intentionality, you do experience it, but you don't blow it off. You don't blow it off by expressing it. Now, these are very subtle things, and as soon as you think you understand it, it'll just simply take another subtle form. So in part, what we're doing is managing energy, and managing the energy that is flowing through us all the time. We have the chapter on sensing, where we're beginning to sense the movement of energy. So as the energy is moving, as we begin to keep it for ourselves, then we just keep something. So I'm not trying to explain it in a different manner, but rather emphasize just that one phrase about negative emotions.
I'd like to make another distinction about that. So in my understanding anyway, the intention of not expressing it doesn't mean that one cannot discuss that in one's work with another person with an intention to become more aware of it. It means that we're not running it automatically in reaction and expressing it, for instance, through, you could say, I'm not expressing it because you're not saying anything, but then broadcast to the entire room that you're really not happy through your posture and the way that you're putting your energy out, and that's a form of expressing it. So, yeah.
And it'll be in all kinds of forms. For some people, the expression of a negative emotion will be mental.
Snide or sarcastic.
Go ahead.
And there's another aspect to this as well, which will sound initially like it's contradictory, but it's not. That is, we all have X amount of energy. If
yes.
we're spending that energy in negative emotions, remember there is no profit ever in negative emotions that are expressed outwardly, but
that are acted out.
That are acted out. That's right. So the idea with managing your negative emotions is only to use that energy for feeding your personal sense of the of your own non-phenomenal self. And so part of it is feeding the moon. That is your personality. But really, the larger portion of that negative energy should be directed toward trying to become aware of your non-phenomenal self. That is that vibratory sensation within yourself, which feels itself to be at unity with everything, without differentiation.
Okay.
I'm still feeling some energy out there of like self-judgment. Someone in the group running some self-judgment about bad and wrong to have negative emotion. And it's not bad and wrong to have negative emotion. It's essential to our work that the disharmony and the imbalance is what we use to wake ourselves up. This is about husbanding that energy, keeping it to ourselves and beginning to mold ourselves with it so that we can use it to transform, not blowing it off and wasting it by just acting out unconsciously. This is not about making negative emotion bad and wrong and feeling guilty about it.
If I can add something, not only I am asking you opening this question because David said something, it's not only not acting it, but David said that those negative emotions appears in the mental state. And it's nothing to do with acting it or not acting it. Acting it, it's in your mind. Isn't it, David? That's what you said?
I'll give you an example of what I mean by a mental negative emotion. Someone says something to you and you feel slighted by it. But you don't express any emotion or anything like that. But in your mind, you have a series of arguments about how you were actually right. They didn't understand you. They didn't see what you meant by that. All of that stuff. And all of it goes on. It appears to be just a chain of thought. That is a form of negative emotion. The fact that people are saying, "Oh gosh, it's bad to have a negative emotion." Excuse me, but that is occurring most of the time. Most of the time, we're in reaction to the world around us. As Silverdale said, and I think Teresa might have indicated too, it's of no profit to us if we feel the negative reaction, the tension from someone, and we react to them and with anger and all of that. It has no profit to our work. It may help some form of the personality at that moment, but it does not further our work because we haven't conserved the energy in a manner that we're able to if we're intentionally working with ourselves.
So, Townsend Girl said, so the moon is part of being almost at the point of beginning to transform. And Silverdale said, yes. And she said, oh, you use the dissonance of the negative emotions and reaction to feed the moon. And he said, yes. As well as feed your non-phenomenal self. The moon refers to our hysterical personality, which we're trying to grow into a planet Earth. And she said, wow, I think I get it. Brilliant. And he said, planet Earth, that is a harmonious, diverse environment with atmosphere.
Now, another thing that we spoke about, we're starting to tie up, in a sense, 20 chapters of exercises And all of them are starting to come to bear for us. And it's a fine meal that's available to us. I'm thinking
there?
Now the doorway exercise. Part of that was to get to hang out with the feeling and sense of what does that vibration called being feel like? Can I get used to that? Can I find that? Can I find it again? Can I find it right now? So when that's occurring as well, then you start to know, in a sense, where to go. And when you're working with the harnessing of that energy in yourself, that being starts to, that vibratory sense, that power of the being, it comes up. It will be there for us. And so you're beginning to exercise the essential self, the non-phenomenal being that's there. That's it.
Can I put something here?
Sure.
David, this is for you, for everybody, actually, talking about negative, man. I'm talking about internal dialogue. Every time I really have a problem here, really. Help me out here, you're an accountant. When I read the news about the banking in the States, man, with Bernanke, Pelosi, man, and all that gang, man, all the henchmen, man, of the Federal Reserve, and the money ran out away to banks in Europe, I really try to hold myself on and say, how can I process that, man, these shysters?
But the reason that we won't process it is because we start to believe that they have free will, that they are acting as free agents, in a sense, and then we don't believe that they are asleep, nor do we, in a sense, believe we are. One person, a particular monk, described it to me the other day as the barbarian king rules the earth. You see these individuals, what they're doing, they are expressing with great effectiveness various negative emotions. They're driven, like the fellow from Goldman Sachs, the trader from French trader from London. And he has tremendous ego and pride for his activities. But if we look at him and we see that he's asleep and he's devoted to his sleep, you can see this is the mechanism that it's worked. Now, they are affecting us too. They are affecting our everyday life.
Is my point. He can do whatever he wants with his life, but the thing is it's affecting cities, countries with his bullshit.
Well, then we have to do things. How do you protect yourself in that kind of environment? And that's a skill set that we all have to learn in our own way. It is very dangerous in the world. But guess what? It's always been dangerous.
And to bring it back to what we were just speaking of, if we just react negatively and we blow all of our energy off complaining to our friends about how it is, which is sort of a pastime, that's very different than if somebody were to take all of that energy internally and then decide to use that focused attention to actually do something about it through constructive actions in the world that could make a difference.
And being less identified with some of these.
Thank you.
Thanks for bringing that up. I think it might be time to...
Shall we move into new day every day? We're probably ready for a new day.
Yeah, why don't you... do you want to pause the recording?
I'm not recording.
Well, yeah, but did you start the recording on the free conference?
Oh, right. Are you changing your tape?
Well, yeah, I thought we were going to discuss a few mechanical things.
Okay, then we'll have two recordings if that's okay.
What do you mean?
Well, you'll have to send me two files here.